So today is the 16th of October, 2014. I'm David Caruso with Carsten Reinhardt, and we're doing our first session of an interview with Roald Hoffman here at Cornell University. Thank you again for agreeing to sit down with us.
Sure.
As I mentioned to you, what I'd like to do is start at the very beginning and hear a little bit about life in Poland. Growing up, you were born in 1937. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what your family was like, where you lived, things like that.
Yes. So the first years of my life were difficult, not of my own doing, mm-hmm. and just geopolitical circumstances of the time. But I was born in July 1937 in a town called Złoczów. It's pronounced in Polish. Now Złoczów. When I was born, it was Poland. When my mother was born, before World War One, it was Austria-Hungary. And when I was born in Poland, then it became the Soviet Union, then it became the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And not only did it change hands, that little piece of the world, but it went through what I would say is 2.5 waves of what would be called ethnic cleansing in the process. Not an easy part of the world. I was born in a Polish-Jewish family. The family was in a typical degree of assimilation of Polish Jews in that time. And my first name, Roald, my last name was not Hoffman. I'll come and tell you that story. Mm-hmm. I was born as Roald Safran, S-A-F-R-A-N. But the Roald is my real name, and even the name reveals a story of assimilation and something about Jews in Poland at that time. So my uncles are named Abraham and Samuel. One is named Friedrich. But there is no way that my parents, my father's name was a Hebrew name, Hillel, that is also my son's name. And my mother's name was Clara. There is no way that they, good socialists and communists that they were going to name their son Abraham or Samuel. So this is a story of generations. The grandparents were observant Jews. The parents were socialists, my parents. They were both born in 1911, so that's sort of just to set the stage. They were very much in touch with their family. They were not that rebellious. So I got a Hebrew name, which is Israel, and the diminutive was Yisruel in the Ashkenazi dialect. And my aunts and uncles still to this day, they're no longer alive, but when they were alive, they would call me Rulush, which was a diminutive for Yisruel. So they were looking for some name that was vaguely sounded like Yisrael, but which was not a biblical name, that was too religious. You couldn't give your son the name of a Polish saint, so Thomas or Michael was out. So you looked for secular heroes, okay? So there are a lot of kids in that time, for instance, boys were named Emil, after Emil Zola, who was a secular hero. And Roald, there's a story which I didn't believe. Roald was after Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer. That was a good, safe, secular name. Now, I've desperately looked for a connection, romantic connection, between my mother and Roald Amundsen. But He died 10 years before I was born, and that's actually the interesting story that I heard, which I didn't believe until I heard it corroborated by someone else. My mother said, well, she just was looking for a name, and there was this magazine article on the 10th anniversary of Roald Amundsen's death, and they thought it was a good name.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was weird, but then I met Roald Sagdeyev, who was a Russian physicist who came to this country, and he's exactly the same age as I am, and he told me the same story. So there was a little corroboration. He was born somewhere else in the Soviet Union, but the story of being named after Roald Amundsen was the community in Zlochev. Zlochev was not a shtetl. It was a typical town of that period, 12,000 people, about ethnically mixed, because that region was.
Mm-hmm.
The region was in part Ukrainian, and so there is a reason why it's in the Ukraine. Population was about one-third Ukrainian, one-third Polish, and one-third Jewish. And they coexisted somehow. The Ukrainians viewed the Poles as invaders, and they were, in a way. Going back hundreds of years. And there was a Jagiellonian castle lording over the town, part of the history of that period. The Jewish community was very well established. There are a number of people in the world who have come from that community. It was, for instance, the home of Yechiel Mechel, the Magid of Zlochev, one of the first followers of the Baal Shem Tov, of the founder of the Hasidic movement. It was also the home of Moshe Leib Halpern, who was a great Yiddish poet. And an interesting photographer, Arthur Fellig, who's better known by his name Ouija, a photographer of crime scenes in New York. Many people came from that town. Anyway, it was a small town in the province where the chief town was Lvov. Lvov was Lemberg in Austrian. It was then Lviv, now in Ukrainian. Lvov was where my father went to school. In the Lvov Polytechnic, there was restrictive laws on the number of Jews in the professions, so-called numerus clausus. The Polish government was to varying degree anti-Semitic in that period, but still it was a very open place for Jews overall. My father went to Lvov Polytechnic, for instance. A classmate of his, I found out later, was a distinguished Polish chemist, Bogumiła Jerzowska-Ciebatowska, who also went to that Lvov Polytechnic. Was also very well known in mathematics. Banach Hoffman and a few other mathematicians were in that place. He got an engineering degree from there. My mother studied education at the University of Vienna. We had relatives in Vienna. So there was a lot of motion. My uncle Samuel studied dentistry in Lille in France. He went out because Jews couldn't study. There weren't enough places for Jews to study dentistry in Poland. The motion to Austria was a natural one, since part of our family, after the First World War, went to Austria, or remained in Austria. So there was a lot of motion across these little pieces, across Europe, actually. My father was a civil engineer. My mother was a teacher, but never taught.
Okay.
So they were born in 1911. My mother has a story. My mother had a very difficult life. She lived to a very ripe age of 94, a strong woman and very important in our survival. And I've recently written a play, Something That Belongs to You, about my mother and me. we just had a German premiere of it in, of all places, Bayreuth. where the local theater did it just now, the end of September.
What is the title of it?
It's called in English Something That Belongs to You.
Yeah.
It's an autobiographical play about my mother and me. In German, it's Etwas, das, or it's called Was euch gehört, simply that. So there's a translation, and the translation will be published soon by a small Theater für Laut, Kantus in Germany. Our relations to Germany, I'll come back to a little later, but of course it's tied up with the war.
Just to ask quickly,
yeah.
Your parents, I'm assuming they were children of war as well, right? They were?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was going to tell you the story of my mother in World War One. So my mother's born 1911.
Mm-hmm.
World War One breaks out 1914. She's one of, at that time, three children. There were two more to come later. Their mother, my grandmother, is taking them on a train from Zwarchow West to Lvov. She gets off the train at Lvov, and there is an Austrian attack at that moment. The front line separates her from the three children, young children. My mother's 3 years old at this point, with an Ukrainian nurse. And I tell the story in the play a little bit. And she is taken, the nurse did everything in the world, was wonderful, taking care of them. The nurse finds the Red Cross. The Red Cross takes the children to an orphanage in Vienna, in a convent. And thereupon, the three children remain for 3 years, 1915, this has happened, to 1918, in this convent. The parents not knowing that the children are alive, until the oldest child remembers the name of a relative, and in the United States, it's a crazy. And the parents find out only in 1918 that the children are okay. But imagine a young child, age 4 years old, separated from her parents. My mother has good memories of that convent, had good memories. And she still bore a scar. One of the nuns was carrying in some soup to dinner in a hut. In a hut pot, and my mother ran to the nun to give her a hug. And got burned by the soup. She had a scar from Vienna in 1916. We have a wonderful picture of my mother as a student in front of a rather Aryan-looking sculpture in front of the University of Vienna. The parents were not religious. They were professionals, as I've mentioned. It was a good time. The grandparents, my grandfather on my mother's side, owned a store. It was called a galanteria, little sewing trinkets and things, fabrics. On my father's side, there was someone who dealt in lumber, as far as we can make out. Of the four grandparents, only one survived the war. Mother's mother. So now comes the story of the war. So for us, the first 2 years, 39 to 41, were not so bad for the Jews. So what happens is the Nazis invade Poland in September 39. There is the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement, a secret division of Poland. The Soviets come into our part. That was the cure from communism for my parents. how anyone could be a communist living 100 miles from the Soviet-Polish border is beyond my understanding. But they were, because that's what progressive young people were, in not just in Poland, but in France or anywhere else. From that generation, and some of the survivors in our family, came the founders of the State of Israel, the kibbutzim, and we have my stepfather's sister was one of the founders of the oldest socialist kibbutz in Mizraim. I have an uncle who had another story. He's my father's brother, the only surviving relative of my father's side of the war, because he had emigrated to Palestine in 35. He was a Jewish boy who liked to ride horses. Jewish boys did not ride horses in those days. So he went to Palestine, where he could ride horses freely. And he became a police officer under the British, a mounted policeman, which was, again, not a profession many Jews took. But the moment the State of Israel was founded, all of a sudden there was a need for policemen, especially policemen who spoke Arabic, as he did. And so there is another story there.
What language did you speak, Tom?
Yes, so at home the languages were Polish and Yiddish, were my mother languages, and I cannot speak either one of them well. There's another story about that now, but those were my mother languages. They were interchangeably spoken. That's a good question. So 39 to 41 we had the Soviets. In general, the Soviets treated the Jews fairly well. They treated the Poles not so well. They treated the Ukrainians worst, because they perceived the Ukrainians correctly as nationalists and opposed to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And there is a terrible story there at the end of the 39 to 41 period, where the NKVD imprisons at the castle 600 members of the, 600 is a large number, the Ukrainian intelligentsia of the town, the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers. And in the week they have in 41, before the Wehrmacht reaches, they proceed to kill the Ukrainians. And because some members of the NKVD were Jewish in that period, that caused an exacerbation of already existing Ukrainian anti-Semitism, which led to terrible things in the first week of that invasion. And I talk about that in the play. The play is autobiographical, though the names are changed. 39 to 41, the Soviets were in. We had nowhere to run. We were trapped. So that is the story of Polish Jewry in general, is that, first of all, many Jews came over from the German-occupied part to where we were in the Soviet-occupied part. So the Jewish population of the town swelled. We had some relatives. And then there was nowhere to go. The Soviets didn't, and nobody wanted to go to the Soviet Union. But there was no way out. The escape channel to, let's say, Palestine, which was always clouded in illegal immigration and other things, was no longer there. It was not a good time.
Did you know about the Sondereinsatzkommandos in West Poland?
Yes. So I'll come to that. We have, firsthand experience of that. In June 22nd, 1941, the Nazis invade Soviet Union. Takes them a week to reach us. Doesn't take very long. there was no longer any Polish army, and the Soviet army was retreating, blew up bridges, communications, that plays a role a little later on. And at that point, that first week was the worst. In that first week in this town, so there were these SS Einsatzgruppen that followed the Wehrmacht and essentially organized killings in the various towns with a Jewish population, of which there were many. Every town had a Jewish population. And it was, in our case, it was SS Einsatzgruppe C, and also this weird Viking division, which was a division made up of Scandinavian mercenaries, essentially, of volunteers who did not behave very well either. Anyway, they went up to the castle. The Ukrainian police and Ukrainians rounded up the Jews, brought them to the castle, where the first thing that happened, this castle, which is now a peaceful tourist site, terrible killing ground. In that castle was used as an NKVD prison. In that castle were 650 or more Ukrainians who were killed by the NKVD in between June 22nd and July 1st. They were buried there in the courtyard of the castle. The Jews were first made to dig out the newly buried Ukrainian corpses, who were then properly, we know the numbers because their families buried them. And then 2,000 to 3,000 Jews were killed up there. It was still largely men and boys. They let the women, by and large, go. In that roundup were caught my grandfather Wolf and my uncle Abram. And Wolf was killed. Wolf Rosen. Rosen was my mother's maiden name. Abraham crawled out from among the dead. To the end of his life, eventually came to the United States, he carried a so-called dum-dum bullet, a bullet fragment. So when he went through in his hand, it was never extracted. So he set off alarms at the airport. We were hiding in a house. We had somehow prepared a secret hiding place at the attic. And I have a memory of going into that place. So now comes the worst part for us, which was, for us, the really difficult part of the war was July 41 to June 44. So June 44, American soldiers are landing at Normandy on D-Day. For us, the war was over. We were freed by the forces of evil, meaning the Red Army. But we were freed in June 44. I'll tell you what happens after that, but briefly, we stayed the end of 41 in our house. A ghetto was being organized. But in 42, we went into a labor camp. Labor camp was called Lotzke. The story of the labor camps is not well told yet. The reason is they were not killing camps, extermination camps, so they somehow didn't capture the public attention. There were hundreds of them. There were typically 100 to 500 Jews and other people in a slave labor situation. No one was killed outright, though people were beaten, but people died from typhus and typhoid. Usually the camps were run by one or two Germans, and the rest were, in our case, a very sadistic man named Herzog, who after the war fled to Egypt. There's another story there. The guards were hangers-on. They were German hangers-on. By that I mean Romanians, Ukrainians, Latvians, people from other places. They got paid well, and there was there weren't supposed to be any children in the camp, but you bribed the guards. You had children in the camp. So they were bribable. They were venal, but bribable. And my mother was beaten by Warzog. She had some scars from that, too. But my father was valuable to the Germans because he had, as a civil engineer, built some of the bridges and culverts and roads in the area. I have pictures of him doing that. We have photographs. Fortunately, we have photographs from before the war, which we saved in that attic. And so he was able to move in and out of the camp. And the only documents we have from that wartime period are, in fact, the passes that my father was given, which say the Jew Hillel Safran is entitled to travel between Zlotchev and Lotsky and such. It was an Austrian construction company that was using the slave labor. People were moving from town to town, repairing the bridges. We were 42 in that labor camp. I was at this point 5 years old. My mother's born 1911. My mother's 31. My father's 31. They're young people. They're organized in socialist Zionist groups. And those groups were politically active and formed some nucleus of a resistance movement. One of my uncles was in the forest in a partisan group. The partisan groups are a terrible story because there were Jewish, Polish, Russian, Ukrainian partisans who were often busy killing each other rather than fighting the Germans, but they were politically oriented. They usually had abandoned Russian weapons, and a couple of people escaped from the concentration camps, came back with a story of what, in the middle of 42, the killing began in the various camps. The ones who were most active in our part were two great killing camps, not Auschwitz, but Sobibor and Belzec. And a couple of people escaped, jumped out of trains, came back, told the story. No one wanted to believe it. No one. It's not only that Roosevelt didn't want to believe it, it's the Jews who were on the ground there who didn't want to believe it. Because they were told they were going to labor. Nobody wanted to believe such a terrible story. But the socialist youth movement tried to organize something, and my father began plotting an attempt to break out of the camp. Weapons, he had access in and out, and in his briefcase he smuggled in weapons at the end of 42, beginning of 43, into the camp from my uncle in the forest. Meanwhile, he was talking to some people around, Ukrainians. Everyone was looking for a place to hide. And he found a Ukrainian school teacher, the only educated man in a small village called Unyev, about 25 to 30 kilometers from Zlotchev, the town. The labor camp was near there. And they found this man who would be willing to hide us. So he took in initially four people, and eventually there was my mother and me and an uncle and a man. And my father was going to join us after the breakout from the labor camp. let's see, the fifth person comes, there would be six people. My uncle came in from the forest. That was the fifth one. My father would have been the sixth. We bribed the guards and walked out at night to this hiding place in January 43, five and a half. My father remains in the camp. And we were in hiding. I'll tell you about that in a while. My father remains in a camp in June 43. The attempt to break out is betrayed by another Jew. And the two leaders, my father and another person, are arrested, tortured, and killed in town in June 30th, 1943. News of that reaches us by letters. There was actually a system of communicating. Two letters came describing the killing. My mother cried, but she didn't want to cry for me, but she told me about it. In this hiding, we're in an attic the first year. Five people, the attic in the middle, just in the very middle of a rather peaked roof in the attic. The attic was used to store books for the school. It's a one-room schoolhouse. On the bottom is a schoolhouse for this village. This village has 200 people and maybe 30 children. And the children all go to this with one teacher. Teacher and the family live in back of the house. In between are two storerooms, one sometimes rented out. Passageway in front is a one-room schoolhouse on the dirt road, which is the village. In the attic of that are the five of us, first four, and then my uncle comes in. It's five. Each day he brings up food, he takes away slops, and there we stayed in that house for 15 months, from January 43 till June 44. We moved after the first winter. We barely survived the first winter. The attic has cracks. It's not, air comes in. I could watch the children playing through a window with slats at one end in the schoolhouse. Among the children playing are three Jewish children. I didn't know this till 1980, who were kept at the monastery. At the end of the road, there was a monastery of the Greek Catholic Church, the dominant Ukrainian denomination there. And those three children are in an orphanage there with false identities. One of them becomes later the foreign minister of Poland, who was very active. He was the head of the Peace Studies Institute in Stockholm, Adam Daniel Rotfeld.
Can I ask what?
Yeah.
What were you doing in that attic for 15 months? I mean, was it just getting up and surviving every day and going to sleep? You mentioned your mom.
I learned how to read.
Education.
My mother was a school teacher.
Right.
There were actually books up there. There were atlases. I was very good at geography. She would invent endless games to play with me to keep me quiet. I must have gotten frustrated, but I was a quiet child. No. I learned how to read there in Polish. I may have learned some Yiddish also. And we just sat quietly. I could stand up and more of it because I was small. The rest of them, the men had trouble. After the first winter, it was judged as the second winter came around, 43 to 44. November or December, it was judged we couldn't live up there, couldn't survive. Ukrainian winter is like Ithaca winter,
mm-hmm.
Maybe a little worse, but about the same. We went into a storeroom on the first floor with no windows, one window blocked up. In that storeroom, we dug out a bunker underneath for when the police would come in the house, which happened once every 5 months or so. Or later in the war, German soldiers were stationed in that schoolhouse. And we would go into the boards we dug out from the earth. I still remember the smell of wet earth. We dug out a place where on a bench five people could sit. And he would move the planks across and move a cupboard across that. And that's where we sat in the worst moments. Otherwise, we were in this room, sort of a 6 by 10 foot room, storeroom. That storeroom, the schoolhouse still stands. The attic is there. The attic has been rebuilt. I have been in that attic twice since then. The storeroom on the first floor where we were has been rebuilt into a classroom. The classroom is a chemistry classroom. And I'm going to show you a picture later of that classroom and me in it. And the children there don't know that I was there, which tells you something about education of Ukrainians about World War II and something else. We stayed there. This man, the school teacher, had a young wife. They had 3 young children. The oldest was my age. In June 44, I was almost 7 when we came out. We walked across one night to the Russian lines. The Russians were advancing. They were stalled near us. We went to Zlochev. We stayed there, and at this point, the kids on the street were Ukrainian largely. I learned Ukrainian. That was my third language at this point. Polish, Yiddish, Ukrainian. In the end of 43, it was, 44, it was becoming clear the Soviets were going to take over that part. So we went west to Przemyśl, a town which was more clearly in Poland. And then following the Russian troops, we went to Krakow.
Who was we at that time? Your mother, of course, and you, but your aunt and uncle also?
Yes. They had a 2-year-old child that was given to a Polish family. When we went into hiding, was also in a labor camp. But then was given to a Polish family because it was judged that the 2-year-old would not keep quiet in the attic, whereas I would. And after the war, they went back to the Polish family, and a Polish family and the child were both killed during the war. So this, the decisions people had to make were just crazy. And a grandmother and a third uncle survived in a bunker in the town of Zlochev, and we reunited after. So altogether, we were the largest family group of about 4,000 Jews. About 200 survived the war in this town. That's about the dimensions of the destruction of Polish Jewry in general. Of those 200, 3 were children, and I was one of them. The other 2 are in the United States also. 3 children survived, but we were the largest family group in that town to survive, of 7 people. A grandmother, 4 of her children, the wife of one, the wives of the other were killed, and I. We moved as a family to Krakow, and in 45, I'm now 8 years old, it's time for me to go to school. I had missed the first grade already. So a deal was made. This is 1 month after the Red Army goes through Krakow. In January 45. A deal was made. The only thing functioning in the way of schools is the Catholic Church. The church continues to function. the future pope is teaching in a neighboring school. My parents strike a deal with the priests and nuns. And the deal is that I would be brought up as a Catholic if they let me into the school, because it was time for me to go to school. So I still have my report cards from second and third grade. My best grades are in catechism. I had all the experiences that a small Catholic kid described very well in Fellini's Amarcord movie. They talk about which priest should we confess to, because this priest wants to hear dirty stories. And this priest tells you too many Hail Marys to say. So this typical kid stuff, Catholic kid stuff. I have a picture of me as a First Communion. I was a choir boy in church. I knew I wasn't Polish. I wasn't a Catholic, but it didn't matter. I knew I didn't know what I was.
How was it adjusting to life, given what you had gone through?
It was easy. In general, children are very adjustable, but even the parents are adjustable. My mother remarried in that first year, a man who had lost his wife in a war, whom she knew from before the war. He was from another town. I'm going to tell you about the refugee camps in Europe in a moment, but the birth rate in the refugee camps was bigger than anywhere else in the world. There were all these people who had missed 6 or 7 years of their lives. I was in classes with kids who were 5, 6 years older than I was, because everyone was catching up. It was life. One was still scrambling where to go, where to do. We wanted to go to America. We had relatives. We almost went to Israel. We almost went later on to Peru, of all places. But many Jews went to South America because they gave visas. And it was very difficult to get an American visa. So my stepfather's name was Naftali Margulies. Margulies' brothers are the ones who sponsored Fritz Haber, right?
Yes.
At some point. But it's not them. It was a good German, Polish, Jewish name. Comes from the Hebrew word for pearl, Margalit. That's what my aunt in Israel is called, was my father's sister. So for a year, I was Roald Margulies. Okay. Now it's at this point, at the end of 45, as we're about to leave Poland, quasi-legally, that I acquire the name Hoffman. So that this is now a story, a bizarre story, but a story which Americans can't understand. I mean, you could imagine you could get a false identity during the war to survive, and many people did. Now the war is over. We are getting a different identity. Why are we getting this identity? Because we're desperate to get to the United States. And just like immigrants today know in Bangladesh or in Zaire or in Costa Rica know the U.S. immigration laws, so we knew about the McCarran-Walters Act and the discriminatory quotas. And we knew that it was better to be a German Jew than a Polish Jew. Because of the stupid American things that discriminated against those lowly Eastern Europeans, but in favor of Middle Europeans. So now comes another bit of geopolitics. Russian troops go through. Becomes clear that the borders of Poland, not so clear. The Iron Curtain is not yet down. The Soviets are doing everything to discourage a Polish government in exile and to install their own communists in Poland. It becomes clear they're going to take the Western Galicia, the part we were in, and the borders of Poland are going to get moved. So the Poles, for their own part, do what they can to discourage the Silesian Germans who are in the part that Poland's going to take over. Those who didn't run remain. And so there's a priest in Mittenwalde, a little village near Breslau, now Wrocław, in Poland, in Silesia. And as part of making life uncomfortable for him, the Poles no longer give him any money to run his parish. So he invents a business which hurts nobody. He sells the birth certificates of German soldiers who were killed in the war. And so Naftali Margulies goes to the village priest in Mittenwalde and becomes overnight Paul Hoffmann, buying a birth certificate of a German soldier. And the irony is pretty incredible in the story. And my uncle, the one who was in the forest, enterprising character, he was in the business of forging documents. He forges a wedding certificate between Paul Hoffmann and Clara Rosen, and my father disappears from the picture. And we become Hoffmann, and that's the papers under which we eventually come to America. So am I? Our immigration was illegal. So what? Nobody's going to deport me now. Anyway, I was a child. But we didn't change the name back then. Anyway, I become Roald Hoffmann. And with those papers, we buy a visa to go to France. We across the border in Prague, we declare ourselves stateless. We acquire one of these Nansen passports that were used, and we wind, after 3 months in Prague, we wind up next in a so-called DP camp, displaced persons camp, refugee camp in the American zone in Austria. And I'm in Austria in 46. I'm now 9 years old. And we're all the time trying to go somewhere, trying to get visas. These camps were nice. I learned German now, my fourth language.
How did you manage to survive in a way where did you have your money from? I mean, how did you
they
manage
worked.
To?
Everyone worked somehow in the DP camps, there was work created. But even in Krakow in 1945, my stepfather got a job. I remember it exactly. He became a representative for a chocolate company whose name you will recognize, Karsten, but not Americans. This is Suchard.
Okay, sure.
A great European, French or Swiss. Big chocolate. This is it got absorbed into Nestle, I think. So that's why we don't know it here. But I remember as a kid, he would give me still to this day, chocolate coming in aluminum foil wrappers. And sometimes the wrappers had legends imprinted on them, and I would collect them. He would bring me them. And I had a collection. I don't have it anymore. So he worked for Suchard. And
what was his profession?
His profession was a businessman. He has a degree from the Handelshochschule in Vienna. That businessman eventually in the United States couldn't find a job. Well, that education was worthless. He found himself eventually as an accountant for a Wall Street firm. So that's what he ended life as. My mother never worked as a teacher. It was, again, a profession you could not carry very well.
What were you doing during these?
I was going to school.
Okay.
I was going to school. I was good at school. Okay, now 47, we are in Austria, in a, outside of Linz. And these DP camps were often old caserne, military encampments. And some of them were quite nice, like in the next one we were in was in a French occupation zone of Germany now. We are in Württemberg now. And in a place called Wasseralfingen near Aalen. And there is a DP camp. And we were living in the officers' quarters, which were very nice private houses, essentially, but inside a kind of enclosure. I'm going to school. I learn German. At this point, I learn Hebrew. Oh, the instruction was in various languages. In the Poland, it was in Polish. In Austria, the DP camp, the school was run in Yiddish. In the second DP camp in Germany, the instruction was in German. But Hebrew was taught. At this point, I get my first exposure to chemistry. So we'll get to chemistry. But, and that was, I've written about that a little bit, but I have to get hold of the books. The American occupation forces in Germany, in their wisdom, decide to teach the Germans about democracy. So they produce a series of textbooks for the schools, which are German translations of American books. We should gather some of them there. Among those, I'm now 10 years old, are the two following books which I remember. One was a very well-known book, and that is a biography of Marie Curie by her daughter Eve, and a book that has inspired many young people. The second book is second book was a biography of a black American agricultural chemist, George Washington Carver, by, and that's what I don't remember. I have it written down here, it doesn't matter. These two books are translated into German by the American occupation forces and used in German schools. And we get them. And I remember being so interested in Carver because he's making all these things, inks and plastics and flavors and other chemicals, all from peanuts, soybeans, and sweet potatoes. And I had never seen a peanut or a soybean or a sweet potato. So I had to look up what those were, and that's what they... You could see there'd be a reason I'd be interested in Marie Curie because she is a Polish heroine. But the idea that the first exposure of a chemist to chemistry comes from a story of a Polish-French woman scientist and a black American agricultural chemist is pretty far out. But it's interesting. That's what happened. I didn't decide to become a chemist then, but they were my first recognizable exposure to chemistry. We moved to another DP camp outside of München in 48, and finally at the end of 48 we get out of the DP camps, and we are assigned an apartment in the most wonderful section of München on the Maximilianstrasse, right above the Kammerspiel, opposite the Hotel Vier Jahreszeiten. You've seen these places.
I have seen these places. And of course, München was a special city.
It was not bombed as badly.
It was not bombed as badly. But how did it feel for you to live in a German city after all?
We were given we were assigned the apartment of a German officer, army officer, and his wife was still there. and she lived in one room. We were given two rooms in this, our little family of three people. We went to a school somewhere, a Jewish school, where everything was taught in Hebrew. My first course in English was in fifth, I was now in fifth class, and I had an English course taught in Hebrew from a Hebrew textbook. I mean, bizarre. But so that Hebrew was my fifth language and English was my sixth. Goodness. How did it feel? So in the reactions of the survivors to what happened are very varied. They vary both in a willingness to talk about what happened during the war or in a suppression of it. And even if they didn't go through the worst times, like Madeleine Albright's, our former Secretary of State, her parents, well, she claims they didn't tell her what they did during the war, but I mean, they were represented, they were Jewish, they didn't tell her. They were representatives of the Czech government in London, but they said nothing of their Jewishness even. There were different degrees of talking about what happened, and there were different degrees of attitudes toward Germany. And I discussed this to some extent in the play. I would say that in our family, and this is not just my mother, so my mother is the important actor in my life, as you can see from this. My stepfather, I didn't get along too well with him, but it was okay. But my father I lost when I was five. My mother was really the central person. She was also the strongest person in her group of siblings. She was the one who kept the family together during the war, after the war, and even in America. Let me just finish this story. In February 49, we finally get a visa to come to the United States. And we leave München, and we go to Queens, and then an apartment in Brooklyn, and I grow up in New York City. I'm now in sixth grade. I'm 11 and a half. This is 1949. And after that, we can tell a little bit of the story after that, but basically at that point we're okay. Going back to attitudes about Germany, in the case of our family, the attitudes toward Germany were reasonably tolerant. There wasn't. My mother, every time a Ukrainian, anything Ukrainian was mentioned, she would say those murderers. And even though it was a good Ukrainian who saved us at great risk to his life, there were also terrible stories. The Ukrainians and the Nazis had together killed my grandfather. The Nazis had chipped off my grandfather and grandmother on my mother's, on my father's side to Belzec in 42. The Nazis had killed my father, but there were stories also of other Ukrainians who hid an aunt, two aunts, who were then given up to the police and were killed. My mother could not, and her brothers too, could not, the Ukrainians were people who had gone to school with. Ukrainians had betrayed them to the Nazis, and somehow it's not that the Nazis were a force majeure that was very much in reach. It was this SS officer who was running the camp who beat my mother, and she had the scars from that beating. But they were somehow the hate of the Ukrainians was worse. This is not untypical of many people who survived, I think. But about Germany, so after the war, we had one relative who remained in Germany. He actually was, he just died recently. He was a carpet dealer in Düsseldorf, Ephraim Bardach. He was not from Germany originally. He was from Poland, and his story of survival is a remarkable story too. But we had no trouble as a family, and I guess I'm describing my mother and stepfather and uncles. They had no trouble going to Germany. Once in a while I would hear a comment about an older person when we were in Germany together about, I wonder what he was doing during the war. That kind of a comment. But I think this matter of, for instance, not buying German cars or something like that, I think that's, for the most part, an American Jewish displaced guilt feeling for not having suffered. At home we spoke, when we first came to America, interchangeably four languages. Initially Polish, Yiddish, and German, because we had living with us my father's sister who came from Austria, and she spoke German. She didn't speak Polish. I made them speak English. So we, at one point we spoke four languages interchangeably at home. Polish, Yiddish, German, and English. My mother did not have strong problems. We even took a vacation one time, a family vacation, where we reunited people from Israel and the ones from Germany and us. And we did it in Austria, in Schruns, a mountain place. We didn't. And now, for my part, I've sometimes wondered about things, but I've also had over the years 22 German postdocs. And these were, many of them, much more sensitive to what happened in World War II than American postdocs, for sure. Because the education's better about the Holocaust in Germany, much better than anywhere else in Europe. But overall, while I, and my relations with German chemistry have been very strong through these 22 young people, plus something else, and that is somehow by chance the kind of work I did coincided with a rise in Germany of physical organic chemistry, so that, for instance, the orbital symmetry ideas got often picked up. I'm thinking of people like Rolf Huskin or Wolfgang Roth or Prinzbach. These are people who tested predictions that were made. We had a great interchange. And I've had no special problems with Germany or Germans. And what I'm telling you is my mother didn't have either. I remember very well the last trip we took, my mother and I, to Europe. She's now 85. She died in 94. And she has macular degeneration. This is in the in the late 80s. She doesn't see very well. And I get an award from Society of German Industrialists, the Verband der Chemischen Industrie. They have a Literaturpreis. I get this award, and they say you can bring your wife. And I was separated from my wife at that time. And we've since gotten together again. And I write to them saying, my wife can't come along, but can I bring my mother? So they said, sure. And though they weren't offering to pay for my wife, when they found out it was my 85-year-old mother, they decided to pay for her business class ticket. Mm-hmm. It was the guy who was the official for them was Heribert Offermans, who you may have met. The meeting is in Baden-Baden. She's treated extremely well. I mean, when you bring your 85-year-old mother to something, they're going to treat her well. But they also do it in style. And the then minister, Kohl, was there. And we met Mrs. Kohl. Anyway, my mother was glowing because her son was being honored, and she was very happy. But she, then at some point, they knew the history, so they asked her a little bit, and she answered honestly, and she said, that we suffered a lot because of Germany, but she was very diplomatic. She didn't mince the words, but she remembered the war in what we talked about, but she also responded positively. My mother didn't have trouble with Germany.
How was it transitioning to the United States? You mentioned having some classes, but were you proficient?
Not much.
Right.
On the boat here, we came by boat, troop carriers. My first, I think, breakthrough in English was a Tarzan comic book that a sailor gave me on a boat here, where I really felt I could read it and understand. I had a cousin here who was a school teacher who made sure I wasn't set back. That I wasn't put in some class because I didn't know English. I remember very well that sixth grade at PS 93 Queens, and then we were in, the schools had numbers in those days. Then it was PS 16 Brooklyn. We were in the old Williamsburg. That was our first, and then I went to Stuyvesant High School. But I still remember my first essay. It was a, it was on an assignment essay in sixth grade. You know, you write a page, and it was about Simon Bolivar. It was American history, history of the Americas, and I wrote, and a teacher read my essay to the class. That was my breakthrough point in English. I learned quickly. I went to Stuyvesant High School, science-oriented school. We took advantage of all the educational advantages America offers. Stuyvesant High School at that time was 70% Jewish kids. Today it is 70% Asian American kids, and you know, they're the same as we were. And the other sort of minorities, immigrant groups, had a more difficult time then and now as well. I do well in school.
In 1951, that's when you started. Roughly.
Stuyvesant High School, yes.
I know that when I was growing up, Stuyvesant High School was a school you had to test into.
Right.
Was it the same policy?
Oh yes, yes. I had to take a test.
Was there a reason why you wanted to go to Stuyvesant above?
No, I think I took the test also. There were three elite schools, Brooklyn Tech, Stuyvesant, and Bronx Science. Bronx Science was the only one that was co-ed. The other two were boys at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a girls' school, Hunter High School, at that time. My sister. I have a sister who was born in the United States, 17 years younger than I am. Half-sister. Same mother, different father. No, I think we lived in Brooklyn and Queens. It was enough of a commute. It would have been too much to go to Bronx Science.
Okay.
So these took from all over. Stuyvesant was the natural one to go to if you lived in Queens, as we did at that point.
And so, Stuyvesant is also known for its science programs. Were you interested in science?
Yes.
At this point? And where, you had the exposure to chemistry through reading books about scientists. So I'm curious to know.
Yes. So chemistry. So there are a few things to say. I played with chemistry sets, as many kids in our period. I remember going down to Gilbert was one of the manufacturers of the chemistry sets. I remember going to the Gilbert showrooms, and I remember buying reasonably not dangerous, sophisticated chemicals from the local pharmacy. You could do that at that point. I played with chemistry sets. I also had a relative, distant cousin who was a stockroom clerk at Yeshiva University, and he liberated some old glassware for me. So I had a little bit of a chemical laboratory, not much, at home at around age, I would say around the end of elementary school, around eighth grade. At Stuyvesant, when I graduate from eighth grade from PS 16 Brooklyn, I get two medals. One is for mathematics, and the other is for attendance. It means I had not missed any class. Hilarious. But the mathematics, so this is typical experience, Asian American Jewish kids from Europe at that time, immigrants in general from Europe are always ahead of American students in mathematics, and that provides an entry point. The same is true for the Asian immigrants. And the other things come later, though they were important for me. At Stuyvesant, the only advanced placement I do not take is in chemistry. I take biology, physics, calculus. And I know, though, why? Because there was a lousy teacher. Usual reason we know about it. The others had good teachers. Probably, I know already. If you had asked me in eighth grade, I would have said I wanted to be a mathematician. By 10th grade, I'm realistic enough to see that there seems to be a talent for mathematics, and I don't have it. That is, there are kids in high school to whom the math comes so easy that I just couldn't compete. I do very well in high school.
Mm-hmm.
900 boys in a graduating class, if you can imagine that. 900 boys. Imagine the smoking in the bathrooms. It goes on. But what I begin to do very good at social studies. I get some history award on graduation. I take French, which by now is now my seventh language at this point. I do well in French. No chemistry, but in my high school yearbook, I don't have it here. If you look under my picture, it says, for what I want to do, it says medical research.
Mm-hmm.
So what that is, it's a compromise between what my parents want me to do, which is to become a doctor. Typical aspiration for the Jewish European immigrants then. Typical aspiration for the poor Asian American kids across the hall whose parents want them to be doctors. So when I was an advisor at Cornell, one of my things was how to instruct these kids to tell their parents gently that they're not going to become doctors.
How was the
medical research was compromised? I really didn't. I got conflicting signals about doctors, so. The conflicting signals were these. Doctors don't know anything except for the specialists.
Mm.
So this is a typical European feeling that specialists are important, which is crazy. And second, the doctors don't know anything and they're always trying to cheat you. They're out after money. Well, I'm a smart kid. I hear that. At the same time, there's nobody in the family who is a doctor. But there are other families. There's one, a dentist in the family. I don't want to be a doctor, but I say medical research. And then in the summer between high school and college, I'm a winner of this Westinghouse Science Talent Search. That many kids at Stuyvesant do that. My project was in physics, nothing to do with chemistry. Out of that Westinghouse Science Talent Search competition, now called an Intel competition, I think, I get a summer job at the National Bureau of Standards between high school and college, age 18, in Washington, D.C. It's now outside of Washington in Gaithersburg. Now, at that time, it was downtown Washington. And I have a friend who has a job at NIH. I go over there, and all of a sudden, I get a revelation. The revelation is many of the people doing research at NIH don't have MDs. Mm-hmm. They have PhDs. Like, a kid doesn't know this. So all of a sudden, I realize I don't have to be a doctor. And then I go to Columbia. I almost went to Cornell here. But I wanted to go to Swarthmore, but this is before needs-based scholarship. My stepfather's unemployed at that point. I got into Swarthmore, but we couldn't afford to go, that I'd go there. At Columbia and Cornell, I get full scholarships. I get rejected at Yale. That's the first of three rejections in my life from Yale. Yale at that time and Harvard and Princeton are still practicing limiting the number of Jews. Mm-hmm. Cornell was long past that. But from my high school, from Stuyvesant, only two kids get into Yale. And we knew that only two each year would get in into these schools. Anyway, I go to Columbia, and the world opens up. But I'm taking pre-med courses. I take introductory chemistry. I take organic chemistry. They're good routine courses. They're not inspiring. I'm not interested in chemistry yet.
Can I back up just for? I just had a couple of questions. What was the cultural transition for you like? I can imagine being a child who grew up in war-torn Europe and coming to the United States. Were your classmates at Stuyvesant, for example, coming from a similar background, or were they mostly U.S.-born and raised?
Most of them were U.S.-born. There were a good number of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
They were generally, if they're going to be 70% Jewish kids from New York, you share a certain ambience.
Okay.
You're going to share. It wasn't, and there was never at any point, even in that first sixth grade class, where I was in neighborhoods where there weren't that many Jewish kids, in Ridgewood, Queens first, I never felt any strangeness somehow. If anything, I assimilate too fast. I'm intolerant of my parents have a job, one in a corset family factory, my stepfather. My mother in a bakery as a saleswoman. In bakery she could speak English. Before that she had some assembly line job. I make them speak English and I'm pretty cruel about it. I'm not proud of that. I think something has changed in America, and I think the Latino political movement has changed that. That is, it's okay for immigrants not to speak English.
Mm.
That was not true in my time.
And you knew that?
I knew that. I felt that I was ashamed of my parents. it was, the assimilation forces were very strong. And it's not just me, I think other immigrant groups also felt this in America. It was in the times, and it was what America meant and felt more than, and that's changed.
When did you become a U.S. citizen?
I became a little ahead of time in at age 18 to get a scholarship that I needed to get, a New York State Region scholarship that I needed at Columbia. So I became an 18. I actually may have become a citizen. No, my parents actually were just a little before then. Let's take a little break.
Sure.
Okay.
We'll go to the bathroom.